The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce Magazine. My first article for you today comes from the front and center section, and it's highlighting Arnold Palmer, who lived from 1929 to 2016. He was a regular guy with an infectious sense of fun and a staid gentleman's game. Arnold Palmer earned fame with a go-for-broke style and showbiz smile. His legion of fans, Arnie's Army, grew with his stunning come-from-behind win at the U.S. Open in 1960. Going into the final round, tied for 15th and trailing the leader by 7 strokes, Palmer birdied 6 of the first 7 holes to erase his deficit. At day's end, he tossed his visor into the crowd in an act of joy that helped transform golf into a spectator sport. His dad was a club golf pro. Born in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, to Deacon and Doris Palmer, Arnold learned to play golf at Latrobe County Country Club, where Deacon worked as course superintendent and golf pro. In 1971, Arnold bought the place. It means, he joked with his dad, "You'd have to work for me." His swing was unorthodox. Palmer went after the ball with gusto. As golf writer Randall Mail put it, Palmer didn't swing the golf club. He smashed the ball with a blacksmith's lash and that crouching corkscrew finish. His first pro victory was in Canada. In 1955, he was a rookie on the PGA Tour, driving to tournaments with his first wife, Winnie. At the Canadian Open at Weston Golf and Country Club near Toronto, the pair slept in a tent pitched near the superintendent's shed. Palmer went on to win the tourney by 4 strokes, his purse, $2,400. Palmer was first at many things. He is credited with launching and pursuing golf's professional Grand Slam, the Masters, U.S. Open, British Open, and PGA in 1960. In 1968, he was the first pro tour golfer to reach $1 million in lifetime earnings, and in 2004, he was the first golfer awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I'll have what he's having. On a break while designing a course in California in the late 60s, Palmer ordered iced tea with lemonade. A woman sitting nearby heard him and asked for that Arnold Palmer drink. The rest is beverage history. And Arnold Palmer is credited with this quote, "You can make mistakes when you're being conservative, so why not go for the hole?" The next article is from the Growing Up section and is submitted by Jack Hahn of Sun City West, Arizona, and it's titled, "Sham Always Made It Through. Son Recalls His Father's Challenges in Tough Times." One of 10 children, my father named John Michael, but known as Sham for his Irish ancestry, grew up on a sprawling farm outside of Dunlap, Iowa. He looked forward to Saturdays when he got a quarter to shoot pool in town. Later, my father taught me many things amid the hard work of raising his family. How to shave, drive a car, play pinochle. Included in the list was how to shoot a fair game of pool. My parents, Sham and Thelma Jean, married in November 1928, shortly before the stock market collapsed. During the Great Depression, my father was among millions of jobless working-class men who stood in bread lines to feed their families, but my parents never talked about being so desperate. Dad later found work through President Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal and the Works Progress Administration. My sister, Bonnie Jean, was born in 1934. By then, our dad had a job at the Ford Motor Company plant in Kansas City, Missouri. Using a heavy grinder, he smoothed out small dents in new models that rolled along the assembly line. He earned 50 cents an hour until he lost his job when the company let go several employees to hire people who agreed to work for less. The union sued, After Dad and others were targeted for picketing the plant, my father decided it was time for us to move on. In 1940, we arrived in California, where Dad got a job at a Lockheed Corporation plant in Burbank. He purchased our first home, a nearly new two-bedroom tract home for $3,400, $50 down and monthly installments of $31. He sold it 7 years later for $10,500. In the early 1940s, we received more good news. The union won its lawsuit against Ford. Dad used his portion of the settlement to buy the only new car he ever owned, and it was a Chevrolet. Finally, at age 43, my father found his calling when he bought a small tavern in rural Oakview, California, about 4 miles from Ojai. The Shamrock Inn opened on St. Patrick's Day in 1947. He loved owning the tavern, and by then he'd earned some simple pleasures. A sports fanatic, Dad was thrilled when I became a sports writer for a Hollywood newspaper and got him tickets to various events. Unforgettable was the night of October 21, 1953, when we attended a football game between Notre Dame and the University of Southern California. We enjoyed an early dinner at Julie's, a popular sports bar in the shadow of the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, while watching a world middleweight boxing championship on the bar's TV. Someone passed a hat with slips numbered from 1 to 15. Whoever had the number of the round when the fight ended would win $75. Dad was glad to draw a low number because odd makers favored Randy Turpin, a ferocious puncher, over Carl Bobo Olsen, who was not regarded as a heavy hitter. I got 15. "Trade you, Dad," I said. "This could go the distance, you know." Dad said no, he wasn't born yesterday. All the same, he should have accepted my offer. Bobo Olsen took the title with a 15-round decision. It was the only time I can remember beating my father at anything. On the way to the Coliseum, Dad had to stop to catch his breath. He recovered, but I worried about him the rest of the night. As he gingerly stepped out of the elevator on the way to the press box, someone behind him whispered, "It's like he's walking on eggs." I'm sure Dad heard, but it didn't matter. He took his seat in front of the large window, eager to cheer for the Fighting Irish. Dad passed away a few months later, but that day attending the game with me was one of the happiest of his life, and it is one of my favorite memories of our time together. Diana Graveman from Palm Harbor, Florida, submits an article for the Growing Up section titled, "A Flair for Repair. Handyman kept the whole neighborhood in good working order." Across the front of the sweatshirt I held up to show my husband, Don, was the phrase, "Grandpa, the man, the myth, the legend." "Will Dad wear this?" I asked. "Probably not," he said. I knew Don was right. My dad, Bruce Musterman, was way too humble to wear anything like that, despite his celebrated status in our family. He was the fix-it man, able to repair anything. The leaky hot water tank, the washing machine that refused to spin, and the car air conditioner that blew hot air. When I was 5, I got a Chatty Cathy doll, a 1960s miracle of toy technology. Everywhere I went, Kathy went too, until she was no longer chatty. I was devastated. But I should have known that a dad who could repair refrigerators could figure out how to make Chatty Kathy talk again. Dad saved my Brownie camera and my junior scientist microscope. He fixed my brother's cap pistols and little toy cars with wind-up motors. Dad mended TVs, radios, toasters, and percolators, and we got frequent phone calls from the neighbors requesting his expertise. Was that engine idling too fast? Did someone's dishwasher have a leak? Was the church having plumbing problems? Call Bruce. When he occasionally ran out of things to overhaul, he built something new, a cabinet, a garage, a back porch with stairs. As a teen, I looked up to my dad less and less. His limitless ability to fix things didn't work for my problems with friends or help my angst over homework or career choices. My grumpiness didn't seem to bother Dad. When my car broke down and I called him for help, he just fixed it. When I married Don, he wasn't a handyman, but over the years, my dad helped him replace the roof on our home and repair every one of our major household appliances. With Dad as a master teacher, I figured my husband would eventually inherit Dad's DIY crown. To everyone's surprise, our youngest daughter, Teresa, is the one who's taken on that role, and she now wears the tool belt in the family. Just like her grandpa, that girl can fix anything. My dad is now in his 90s and can no longer lift things or handle heavy tools. Teresa encourages him to supervise when she is doing a repair, and we remind him that she inherited her uncanny handiness from him. My next article for you is written by Natalie Weisong, and it's titled Thrills by Design: Amusement Parks Were an Escape from the Ordinary, Showcasing a Spectacle and the Latest Technology to Entertain Crowds. Theme parks added culture with cherished icons and images that led visitors into a land of the imagination. And the first theme park to share with you is Coney Island in New York, New York. Transit companies looking to attract riders during the not-so-busy evenings and weekends hit on the idea of making the end of the line a destination. On the outskirts of American cities, large and small, so-called trolley parks rewarded long-haul passengers with swimming, games, music, and dancing. A seaside destination from the 1870s onward, Brooklyn's Coney Island was known as heaven at the end of a subway ride. Visitors bought tickets for steam-powered attractions, such as an elevator that carried them to the top of a 300-foot-tall iron tower, a hand-carved carousel, and the Switchback Railroad, one of the world's first roller coasters. Coney Island's Sea Lion Park opened in 1895 with a new concept: paid admission to get into the fenced grounds. Inside, visitors watched sea lion shows, rode the tight curves of the blackout-inducing flip-flap railway, and tried the new sport of shooting the chute by riding a boat down a 300-foot-long trough at 40 miles per hour into an artificial lake. Other famous amusement grounds, such as the rowdy Steeplechase Park and the ambitious Luna Park, lit up at night with 250,000 lights, opened on Coney Island within a few years. Cities building parks copied many of Coney Island's attractions, and sometimes its name. By the 1920s, nearly every major American city supported a park. In these new public spaces, people of different social and economic classes and backgrounds were cast together, literally in the case of Steeplechase Park's Barrel of Love, and the Blowhole Theater, where gusts of air from under the floor lifted women's skirts, swept away Victorian protocol. The cattle prod applied to male spectators was a quick buzzkill. A major exception was the exclusion of African Americans from most amusement parks and swimming pools until the 1940s and in many cases beyond. During the Great Depression, attendance at parks declined and operators, still transit companies in many cases, could not maintain them. World War II caused shortages of the raw materials used to build rides. After the war, as car ownership became the norm, the allure of taking a crowded streetcar to the old parks faded. And the next theme park is Santa Claus Land in Santa Claus, Indiana. After the post office in Santa Claus, Indiana was established in the 1850s, the small town in the middle of the country became a favorite place to send letters to Santa. Children liked getting return mail with the town's unique postmark, but when they visited, Santa himself was nowhere to be found. Evansville industrialist Louis Koch saw opportunity to give people what they wanted and bought land for a park devoted entirely to the Christmas holiday, opening Santa Claus Land in 1946. Cox's adherence to a single theme was something new. Santa Claus Land featured wintry decor, alpine-style buildings, and details including rides designed for children, a workshop, and a house of dolls. The biggest attraction was Santa, portrayed by Jim Yellick for more than four decades, who visited daily. Over time, the park that staked it all on the idea of Christmas added more holidays to its themed lineup and is now called Holiday World. From the Trivial Pursuit section, here's an article titled Rooting for the Rat Pack. Las Vegas usually takes our money, sure, but what if the opposite occurred? The original Ocean's 11 became one of Warner Brothers' most profitable pictures upon its August 1960 release. And while some movie critics thought that the tale, centered around theft, was immoral, most reviewers declared it a fun fantasy romp and quite a clever scheme. In 1958, actor Peter Lawford bought the story idea from a movie director pal and later approached fellow members of the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., and Joey Bishop, with a screenplay about a caper set in Sin City. After he saw the script, credited to Harry Brown and Charles Lederer, with uncredited help from Billy Wilder, Sinatra supposedly joked, "Forget the movie, let's pull the job." The film's plot was the perfect setup for the Rat Pack to play on-screen versions of themselves, a hard-partying, misbehaving circle of friends. The premise, with Old Blue Eyes as leader Danny Ocean, had Army veterans assembling to pull an elaborate heist. That each of the 11 members of the star-studded group brings a special talent to the mix, which makes them uniquely equipped to knock over a bunch of casinos, just adds to the fun. Stars played their parts with ease, peppering the film with inside jokes and ad-libs. Filmmakers also took advantage of the real-life talents of Davis and Martin, who both sing in the movie. Audiences enthusiastically cheered on the rogues, but the story throws one monkey wrench into the gang's works, proving that a plan is never simple, at least not in Hollywood. And also from the Trivial Pursuit section, I have some questions for you about the Flintstones. Yabba Dabba Doo, Americans gathered in front of their TVs on September 30th, 1960 to watch the first primetime animated sitcom. The Flintstones will go on to hold the record for airing the most episodes of any such show until overtaken by The Simpsons. See if you can answer these questions. These two producers, already known for creating Huckleberry Hound, reunite for this show. That is William Hanna and Joseph Barbera. Fred, Wilma, Barney, and Betty resemble human characters from this mid-1950s sitcom. Do you know the name of the sitcom? The Honeymooners. Producers considered two other last names before they chose Flintstone. What were they? They were Flagstone and Gladstone. Can you finish this line? Flintstones, meet the Flintstones. They're the modern Stone Age family. What is the name of the prehistoric town where the cartoon is set? It is Bedrock. Fred works as a Bronto crane operator at what construction company? Do you remember the name? Slate Rock and Gravel. Who voices the characters of Betty and Barney Rubble, respectively? It is Bea Benaderet and Mel Blanc. And lastly, what are the names of the Flintstone and Rubble children? That would be Pebbles and Bam Bam. From our Word Wise section, we have the word soul food. Soul food's roots are entwined with Southern cooking. They share ingredients and handed-down techniques. Black people leaving the South took along the cuisine, and as the civil rights movement grew, soul food came into common use per Merriam-Webster, connecting them to their unique heritage. Soul also applied to music, brothers, and sisters. Zephyr Wright, expert soul food cook and the Lyndon B. Johnson family's private chef, told the president of her experiences with segregation. LBJ used these firsthand accounts to gain support for the 1964 Civil Rights Act. In the True Love section, Elaine Lang from Cronenwetter, Wisconsin, submits an article titled, Learning from the Best. Mom and Dad Show How to Share a Rich Life Together. Dad, Tony Salzman, was born in the small community of Castle, Wisconsin in 1913. He had a great sense of humor. He always told his kids that he was born in a castle. Our mom, Edna Hank, was born in Rib Falls, another small town about 4.5 miles from Castle in 1914. They were married just shy of 50 years. Dad worked at what became 3M Company for 5 decades, but his wife and family were always the most important part of his life. He made me feel that I was his favorite child, but I think all 5 of his kids felt the same way. He and Mom loved it when the whole family got together. Mom and Dad had a special relationship that was more romantic than any of us realized. When I was packing up Mom's possessions a few years ago, I found dozens of Valentines Dad sent her over the years. My parents enjoyed traveling, especially with the camper that was Dad's pride and joy. They taught us to appreciate all living things, from woolly bear caterpillars to large wild animals. In summer, they liked to drive to a special place after dark, roll down the windows, and listen to the frogs. Mom and Dad had this nut about the size of a walnut that they must have found on one of their many walks. We called it the knot. For years, they gave it to each other as a gift. Dad would wrap it up with a big bow and set it aside for Mom to open, and she would make a big fuss as she did. The next Christmas, Easter, or Father's Day, or on his birthday, the knot would appear all wrapped for Dad to open. They kept up this exchange for most of their marriage. Every time the knot was being presented again, Mom and Dad glanced at each other and smiled. We kids would roll our eyes at them. Oh, here they go again. I'll never forget that look they used to give each other. I'm sure they didn't realize it at the time, but they were showing us that it made no difference how much a gift cost or how big it was. What mattered was the joy of giving and receiving. Mom and Dad showed us what real love looks like and that it should be treasured. I found their love knot packed away with Mom's things. Today, I have it tucked close with my favorite mementos. From the Memory Lane section, Ruby Helen Smith of Phoenix, Oregon, submits an article titled, Twins Give Dad a New Job. When Elmer and I realized I was pregnant, I visited a doctor in Inglewood, California. We were living in Santa Monica at the time. Everything was fine at that first visit, but the doctor did ask me if there were twins in my family. I told him no, and he told me not to worry about it. We didn't worry about it, and I didn't ever see that doctor again. Elmer's cousin, Harold Alexander, was in medical school in Los Angeles. He insisted that I get under the care of his favorite practicing instructor, Dr. Reynolds. It was a long way for us to drive, so the doctor saw me once a month. He said I was doing so well that I didn't need to come more often. I would pick up Elmer at Douglas Aircraft Company, where he worked as a tool and die maker, and he'd shave and change his clothes on the long ride to the doctor's office. We didn't have a phone in 1940. There was a waiting list to get one at that time. Late on July 2nd, we decided I should go to the hospital. By the time we were driving down Olympic Boulevard in Santa Monica, it was 1 a.m. There was not much traffic, so Elmer just slowed down at the red signals. Soon, here came a cop who pulled us over for not coming to complete stops. He took one look at me and let us go. Larry arrived at 8:59 a.m. July 3rd, and Lloyd 2 minutes later. Someone woke up dear Elmer, who was asleep in the waiting area. Fathers weren't allowed in the delivery room then, and told him I'd had twins. It was a surprise to everyone. I didn't know how I was going to manage one, let alone two, but Elmer was a rock. He washed diapers for 1 year, before disposables were common, of course. I loved California and thought we'd stay there forever, but just before the boys turned six, we moved to Southern Oregon because we wanted to raise our sons in a less populated area. We will always be thankful we have such wonderful sons. From the Keepsakes articles, David Warren of Miamisburg, Ohio, submits an article titled, Snagging the Past, Old Mitt Holds Fond Memories. When I came across my old baseball mitt in a wooden crate recently, my mind flashed back to my boyhood and endless summer days in Ohio. Suddenly, Dad was teaching me how to scoop up ground balls, and I felt again the sting of a wild hop that I stopped with my face instead of the mitt. I threw the mitt down in frustration, but Dad taught me not to give up if life takes a bad bounce. Next were the smell of mown grass and chatter of my little league teammates as I chased a fly ball that, to my surprise, somehow found its way into my mitt. Later, I brought it to my first Major League Baseball game in Cincinnati, hoping to catch a foul ball in the stands. No such luck. I still have hopes of getting a foul ball someday. When we moved from Ohio to Illinois, I met an Irish lad named Patrick Sullivan, and we spent many an afternoon tossing a scuffed-up baseball back and forth as we talked about girls, school, sports, and our hopes and dreams. I'm not sure where Patrick is these days, but I sure wish we could catch up. My trusty baseball glove followed me to college, where I was team MVP in an intramural tournament. I helped us win a big game with two doubles, and I snagged the final out with my mitt. Once again, no one was more surprised than me. In the time capsule section, we're going to look at some words that Merriam-Webster added to the dictionary in 1960. Blindside. NFL fans fear the worst when New York's Frank Gifford goes down after Philadelphia linebacker Chuck Bednarik jolts him with a tackle that he never saw coming. Doofus. Meaning a foolish, stupid, or incompetent person, this bit of student slang may stem from the Scots doof or dolt. Health Spa. The exclusive Golden Door Retreat gains fame as a destination for the rich and famous to rest and recuperate. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.